Welcome, everybody. This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham, and we are here as a public service today, more than just for entertainment value. We're here to help you with your holiday shopping. For all you cowboy fans especially, Christmas is right around the corner, and if Christmas is around the corner, then Hanukkah is standing in the hallway. And so we are delighted to welcome an old friend and one of the most well-respected NFL writers in the country, Gary Myers, who is the author of many books, the latest is which is called How About Them Cowboys? And we'll show you the cover on social media, but the subheading says, Inside the Huddle with the Stars and Legends of America's Team. So thanks for doing this. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you. And one of the highlights of the book was you agreeing to write one of the endorsements on the back, and I mean that sincerely because we've known each other since 1981, and you are as associated with this team as anybody. And so I just want to get that out there that I appreciated that.
Yeah, you bet. And Gary just reminded me before we started talking that there was I was the host of a radio show 30-something years ago.
Yeah.
We called the Football Writers Roundtable, and you, as one of the Cowboys beat men then for the Dallas Morning News, you were one of the regular panelists. Those were fun, and I think it may have started certainly in the Southwest. It started the trend of newspaper writers getting a couple little extra pennies for doing radio shows, and some of them really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I will say I wasn't one of the Cowboy beat guys. I was the Cowboy beat guy. It was unlike today where the morning news has, I just saw in the press room, you know, they have 3 and 4 people here every day. For the most part, it was me, and then sometimes Galloway would come out or David Castevens or Dan Barrero. But on a day-to-day basis, it was me, and I was happy to have a little company every now and then because the newspaper war was so intense that I didn't like it when I got outnumbered by Jim Dent and Frank Luxor or with the Star Telegram, and get Kenny Sins and Paul Hagan every day. So, and that writer's round, you know, that was the first time I ever really did radio on a consistent basis. I had done a little in New York, but doing it every week for the better part of, I guess, four or five years, I really learned a lot, and I've done an awful lot of radio since then. In New York now, I host a show on Saturday afternoons.
You're welcome.
During the football season. So it's my long-winded way of saying I appreciate it because I learned a lot from you, and I mean that sincerely, that how to pace a show and how to ask questions and things of that nature.
The then and now aspect of these conversations is what has really been the most attractive element to me. And the now we're going to get to in a little bit because this is not exclusively, but this book is primarily about some of the inner workings of the Cowboys sent from 1989 forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some great stories in there, and I don't want to tell people so much that they feel disincentivized to buy the book, but I want to have you tell enough stories
and
tease them
a
little bit. But I do think that as for the then part, that it makes sense for people to – many of you listening outside the Dallas-Fort Worth area certainly are familiar with Gary's work as the NFL writer for the New York Daily News for many years. Your book about Tom Brady and Peyton Manning – a bestseller, right?
Yeah,
a
New York Times bestseller.
That's got to be kind of a rush.
Oh, it was. I'd say it's the greatest accomplishment that I've ever had, an individual accomplishment. You know, I've taken pride in the newspapers I've worked for doing well, and I was inside the NFL for many years when it was the football show on TV. But as far as an accomplishment that I'm most proud of, when I saw my name and my book on that list, I'm going, wow.
You made it.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I have high hopes for this one. So,
well, all right. So that's an interesting next step in the conversation because you obviously, if you're writing about the NFL, sooner or later, somehow, good or bad, you're writing about the Dallas Cowboys.
Right.
But your reputation and your body of professional work now makes you a national writer. So what about this current edition of the Dallas Cowboys and from 80 Cowboy fans in the Dallas-Fort Worth area particularly will tell you that the salad days of the three Super Bowls are ancient history. Some of us don't feel quite that way, but what made you think that a book about the Cowboys and the inner workings of it since Jerry Jones and his family bought the team had national appeal?
Well, I mean, what fascinated me at first and the way I was going to approach it initially was, how is this team that hasn't been in the Super Bowl in 22 years, how has their value grown to $5 billion, by far the most valuable team in the world? And how has their popularity continued to grow where they're still the most popular team in the world and probably by a very wide margin? So that was my premise going in, is how is the branding work and how is they has just, again, just the popularity of the team just continued to, it's exploded, despite the fact they haven't had the success on the field to back it up. So that's how I approached it initially. And I had three meetings with Jerry that covered about 5 hours. And Brad, as you know, when you get 5 hours with Jerry, you get at least five questions.
Yeah, maybe three or four.
I say one question per hour was about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe a couple of follow-ups in the middle of that when I interrupted him. You know, it's funny, the second interview I did with him was on the phone, and I did it from home on a Saturday. He had actually called me back as I was walking into Pat Shurmur's introductory press conference in January with the Giants, and I said, oh, God, you know, I've been waiting all week for him to call me back, and of course he called me back at the one time I couldn't talk to him. So he says, here's my number, call me at home on Saturday. So I called him at the appointed time. I love doing interviews in person. They're much better. But on the phone, there's a certain relaxed way of doing it. You don't have to worry, you know, making eye contact like you and I are doing right now. So I just put my feet up on the desk. I had my tape recorder going. I hope he was as comfortable as I was. And every 20 or 30 minutes or so, I'd ask him a question, and it went for 2 hours. And it was great. But as I started getting into the interviews and getting into the meat of the project, I found there was much more that I wanted to get into. Initially, the name of the book was going to be Cowboys, Inc., which is what the name of the second chapter was. But as I started doing interviews, and I just found there was so much more I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about some of my own experiences. I wanted to talk about the Landry years. So I just made the business part really the second chapter, and Jerry Jr. was extremely helpful. And he's the Jones child, if you want to call him that, that nobody knows much about. Although Jerry says he's the most like him of any of his three kids. And so I did a little from the Landry era, some from the Jimmy Jerry era, from the Jerry without Jimmy era, and tied it all together. It's a very anecdotal book. People who have read it have told me it's a really quick read. Probably on a flight to New York to Dallas, you can read the whole thing, especially if you get the usual delays. And I think it's pretty cool. I mean, I really liked it. It's my favorite of my five books.
Really?
You know why, Brad? Because with Brady Manning, I was really into it, especially because Brady gave me incredible access and time. We drove together from Gillette Stadium to downtown Boston, where he was living at the time, and he was driving, and he's really good because he's done a lot of his conference calls on the phone. And I was just rooting for the most hellacious traffic jam of all time. You know, we went at rush hour, and Tom was too smart. He knew the ins and outs of the highways and stuff. And it took a little over an hour, but then we sat in the car and talked for a while, and we had a couple of follow-up interviews. So I really enjoyed that. But this one was personal for me because, and I've told people that.
And pay attention, everyone. We're about to get a little deeper into the then part of this, this picture.
My time in Dallas and my job with the morning news were cherished moments for me. I loved living in Dallas. If it wasn't for the fact that the woman I wanted to marry was a dentist, and had no desire to take the dental board exams in Texas because her license would not transfer, I might have stayed. But so I love living in Dallas.
Heart wants what it wants.
Yeah, exactly. But my job at the morning news was the best job I ever had. And I've had some good jobs since then.
You have. You certainly have. Now people who are a little younger should understand the impact that Gary Myers had on the way the Cowboys in particular are covered in Dallas-Fort Worth. And I think it's instructive for people to hear you talk a little bit about what you do in the first chapter of the preface of the book about what your approach was to the newspaper war in Dallas when you came here in the early 80s, and to, I mean, you kind of consciously intended to upset the apple cart a little bit.
Well, I was just being myself, and how I learned teams and should be covered when I was in New York, and I had worked for the Daily News prior to my most recent 29 years there, and you become ingrained in the tabloid mentality. But that wasn't exactly the approach I wanted to take here because it was a different market. But I knew I didn't want to take the approach that had been taken previously. When I don't,
which was, in your opinion?
Yeah. I really got the impression that the newspaper shied away from the controversial topics that I won't say – maybe they were a little bit of an extension of the Cowboys Weekly, that the writers were very concerned about maintaining themselves in good standing with the organization. – Me, I knew the Cowboys. The only player, I watched the Cowboys on TV. I had no allegiance to the Cowboys. The only player I knew was Dorsett. He was at Pitt when I was at Syracuse, and when I wrote for the Daily Orange at Syracuse, I did a story on Dorsett, and I actually brought that with me to Dallas to show him, to try to establish a relationship with him. But I had no, I wasn't trying to protect anything that to be considered a member of the club. I just came down here and covered it like I thought it needed to be covered. So that meant 3 months after I got here, running a story about and with a chart how much each of the Cowboy players were making, and a whole story about how it compared to the rest of the league. And then Doug Todd, you know, may he rest in peace,
Cowboys
PR director, who I then later became very friendly with. But he wasn't used to me, and he called me when that story ran in the paper. It was bannered across the top of the morning news sports section. And Doug calls me, and I write about this in the book. He goes, you know, you hurt my family. And I said, geez, Doug, what did I do? He goes, you wrote about our salaries. I said, well, I didn't write about yours or your wife's or your kids. I wrote about the team. The team is my family. And I said, listen, I'm not even going to come close to apologizing because you better get used to me. That things are changing here because this team needs to be covered, I believe, in a different way, and that's why they hired me, to write about the stories that people haven't written about before that really have been written about around the country. So Dave Smith was incredibly supportive, and he's my sports editor and one of the giants of the industry. That's why he hired me. So I wasn't all of a sudden going to go soft because Doug Todd and Tech Schramm and Gil Brandt, you know, weren't used to somebody like me. So, you know, I had to be really thick-skinned. And again, I tell the story in the book about the first training camp in Thousand Oaks, which was, I got here in December of 81. This was the summer of 82. We stayed in the dorms in Kowloon, which was dehumanizing. and on the first night of camp, Doug Todd and Jim Dent, I didn't name Jim in the book, but I'll say it here, might have been out late at night. At 3 o'clock in the morning, we're chanting "Myers sucks" outside my dorm window, and I'm going, you know, I'm not in New York anymore.
No,
you know,
right.
And I'm kind of standing out a little bit because I do things differently. And at the first team meeting that night, Brad, Landry, who I developed a nice relationship with in that off season, as I tried to get to know him, tells the players at camp, you know, hey, fellas, you better be careful now. We have a New Yorker among us.
Hold on right there.
Yeah.
I want to read everybody two paragraphs.
Okay, go ahead.
The introduction. You write, Landry was much more civil. He was the best to cover, straightforward and honest. Call me at home if you have a question, he told me. I don't want you to be wrong. I was there to cover the beginning and the end of his football demise, and it wasn't pretty. He told the players in the opening evening team meeting at my first camp to be careful, because we have a New York writer covering us now. So was he being honest, completely honest, both with you and with them?
Well, the funny thing about that was, you know, you tell that to the players. I think it's with the understanding that the players, you know, what we say here stays here, and you know they had to go to breakfast before practice, so. And I was trying to get to know most of them, so I would be up really early and hang out in the cafeteria at breakfast and chat with them a little bit before they went out to practice. And I had three players tell me on the way to the dining hall what Landry had said to them the night before. So I said that first of all, I considered a degree of respect that Landry had for me. Like, let's be careful around him.
He had personal knowledge of what he would consider to be a New York writer for a long time, having been with the Giants.
Right, and things were different then. I mean, he left New York after the 59 season, so the tabloids did change in that period of time from 1960 to 1981.
Wouldn't have known that.
Right. It had become much more cutthroat.
Right.
But he had had a taste of me in the off season.
Yeah.
So he knew.
So the one more thing about that era, and then I want to get into some of the more current things that I think are the selling points for your book. How about them Cowboys? The quarterback controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Let me hasten to add, Tom Landry probably invented the quarterback controversy when he couldn't decide from one play to the next between Staubach and Morton in the early 70s, but after the 83 season, they'd been to three straight championship games with Danny White as the quarterback. They lost them all,
and then they lost to the Rams, remember, the end of the 83 season in the wild card round, I think.
That's right. And then you ran a poll. That's right. And then you ran a poll in the Dallas Morning News. I'll let you tell about what the poll was, but this to me was the when I think back in the history of the way the Cowboys have been covered, especially by newspapers, this was the one moment that blew up the status quo.
Yeah. Now, your memory is a little better than mine, probably. The 82 championship game in Washington when Danny got knocked out, was it Dexter Manley or was it Charles Mann? I don't remember who sacked Danny and they put Hogaboom in.
Yeah, I remember Darryl Grant batted down a pad.
Right.
It might have been Manley. Okay. I believe it was Manley.
Okay, so then Hogaboom comes in for the first time. And although—
That's Gary Hogaboom, who was the backup quarterback to Danny White.
Had a gun for an arm. And he lit it up for a little while. And then if I remember correctly, he threw some costly interceptions late in the game and the Cowboys lost their third straight championship game. And the players loved Hoagie, because during the 82 strike, Danny was meeting privately and secretly with Tex Schramm, trying to settle the strike on his own, and the players really resented that. So then they lose to the Rams in the they lost to the Redskins, the third straight championship loss, and they lose to the Rams. I didn't have a good relationship with Danny. If you remember, Brad, before that game, the 83 wild card game, there was an ice storm in Dallas, so it was really cold, so they went to Houston to practice. Dave Smith, I mentioned, my sports editor, had to send Barry Horn to Houston with me because Dave wanted a Danny White story, and that was a period of time, and we ran hot and cold.
You weren't getting it.
No, there was no way. Danny was not talking to me. And, you know, when Danny wanted to talk to me, he was great, and I know you had a very good relationship with him.
Did and do.
But Danny didn't like me, and that was okay. You know, it's a hazard of the business. So in the 84 off season, now they lose in the wild card round, and I decide to do a poll asking two questions of the players: who do you want the quarterback to be, and who do you think Tom Landry is going to pick? And so I got 38 players during the course of about a month going out to that old dump on Forest Lane for the off-season workout program. And it was overwhelmingly that they wanted Gary to start, but it was overwhelmingly that they thought that Tom would pick Danny because Danny was considered Tom's guy. And when Tom made the announcement that it was going to be Danny, he referenced, "I got a good feel for how the players feel about our two quarterbacks, and I just don't think Danny is capable of leading this team right now because of the way they feel about him." And the way he knew how they felt about him was the result of that poll that I did. So not that it was my intention to get Gary Hogaboom the job, but there was a quarterback controversy lurking, and people just had to be made aware of it. And the best way
your job was to cover the team, not to pick the lineup. That's the coach's job.
No, of course. And I wasn't playing sides, and I didn't really have much of a relationship with Hogaboom because he hadn't been playing. I didn't have a good relationship with Danny, but that had nothing to do with it. I just needed to show the readers how this team felt. And rather than just running a story, we're talking to two or three players with anonymous quotes. Now, the poll was anonymous, but at that point, I'd been there a few years, and I was counting on the fact that my readers trusted me. I wasn't making anything up. But in order to get the answers and get the players to be honest, I couldn't use their name. I mean, it's impossible to use their names in something like that. And it had a big impact. And, you know, I was very happy that I did that. And I know the Hogeboom was happy. Again, that wasn't my intent, but it got him his opportunity to play.
It's a great point that you make about your readers had to trust you
right.
for that to happen. And when you write a book like this or the one you wrote about Brady and Manning or any of these books, the people involved, in order for you to get the stories to tell that people will spend their money on, they've got to trust you.
Right.
So how did your relationship with Jerry and his family evolve?
Well, as you know, Brad, I was here when Jerry bought the team, but then I left in May of 89 because she wouldn't move here.
Not that that's ever come up or that you've ever
let that go. I was ready to move back because my whole family was in New York, so I knew I was going to move back at some point. And I got some great job offers, you know, from the Daily News and from HBO, so it all made sense. And then I was able to set my wedding date, and everything kind of fell into place for me. But I did get to know Jimmy and Jerry during the close to 4 months that I was here. So I had a relationship with them. I knew Steven a little bit because he's the only one of Jerry's three kids that was with him from day one here. And I got to know Charlotte over the years at league meetings as she's evolved into the most powerful woman in the NFL. Jerry Jr., I had met a couple of times, but I really didn't know him. But then certainly over the years, with Charlotte and Jerry Jr., it was evolved over the years, mostly with Jerry Jr. just doing the book. But with Jerry and with Steven, I'd see him all the time at league meetings. I'd see him twice a year. I always went to the Giant Cowboy game because I wanted to make sure I came back here once a year. And then during Super Bowl years, I covered all the Cowboy playoff games because I got to pick which games I wanted to cover. So I always wanted to write about the Cowboys. And so although I wasn't here, I felt that my relationship with Jerry was as good as maybe anybody who was here the whole period of time. And I had done a story on him in December of 2016 before the Cowboys played the Giants up in New York. Jerry was at a league meeting. I called Rich Dalrymple and I said, I'd really like to write a story about the Jerry years for the Daily News as he's on the verge of getting in the Hall of Fame. And the vote hadn't happened yet. But
and you're a voter, buddy.
Yeah, I'm a voter. And so the vote hadn't happened yet. It wasn't going to be for another 6 weeks, but he was the finalist that was picked for the contributor category with Paul Tagliabue. In most cases, it's a slam dunk. It turned out to be for Jerry, but not for Tagliabue. So I don't know if it was the fact that I had a pre-existing relationship or the fact that I was a voter and he was anxious to get a story in the Daily News. But I went and met him in his hotel.
By the way, you should have shot for like a Maserati or something.
No, because that would have been a trade-off.
And I can't do that. The ethical violation.
Yeah. So I met with Jerry for 2 hours in his hotel room in New York. And I wound up using a lot of that interview in the book as well. But I wrote a very long story about him in the Daily News. And I saw him the night, I think it was a Sunday night game. And so I saw him that night at Giant Stadium. And I thought it was fair. With him in the story, pointed out the good stuff, pointed out the bad stuff. And, you know, he's a big boy. He's got thick skin. He knows he can handle it, you know. And so when I decided I wanted to write the book, my first call was to Rich. And I said, I can't write this book unless Jerry cooperates with me. The book is not in conjunction with Jerry. I just need him to cooperate. And he said, no problem. I can't tell you when he'll sit down with you. You know how Jerry is. He's hard to pin down, but I'll get him for you. And I called my publisher. I said, I'm in. Because I know I'll get Jerry. And I didn't get Jerry until I was walking into Pat Shermer's press conference.
Which brings us full circle.
And then I got him again at the league meetings in March just to tie up some loose ends. So I had about 5 hours with him, which was plenty. I never run out of questions, but I got to all the important ones. And then I met with Steven and Charlotte when I was here last October. And I spent a lot of time with them. I came back to see Steven the next day. And then I spoke to Jerry Jr. a couple of months later. And basically chapter two, which is Cowboys Inc., as I mentioned, all about the business of the Cowboys and monetizing the stadium and the star. Jerry Jr. Was the point man on all that stuff. And I think people will learn a lot about him by reading that chapter.
Let's let's pick a favorite story that you would like people to know about as a reason to buy the book and read the book from the Super Bowl era, from the Parcells years, and the Parcells years then give birth to Romo, Witten. I know you write a lot about their relationship.
All right, so from the Super Bowl years, Jerry told me, and I really believe this to be true, that he handles failure much easier than he handles success. And I think that is really exemplified in his relationship with Jimmy, that when they were going 1-15 in the first year, and I think it was 7-9 the second year, and especially the first year when they're getting criticized and they trade Herschel Walker and people are saying, what does this guy from Arkansas know? And this is a college coach. All the criticism, I think, bonded them because they really just had each other. And so I was really intrigued by Jerry's characterization of that, that once they started having success, there's not enough credit to go around. And he wanted to be known. I mean, he took a team that was an organization or a business that was losing $300,000 a day, $1 million a month, and he turned it around within 2-3 years. Jimmy took a team that was 3-13, and he had him in the Super Bowl in his fourth year. He had him in the playoffs in his third year. But nobody was standing there saying, wow, look what Jerry did. He's making a lot of money. They were looking, look what Jimmy did. He's got him in the Super Bowl in the fourth year. So Jerry wanted a chance to play with his toy, and Jimmy didn't want to let him in into the sandbox. And so that built up a lot of resentment between them.
And Jimmy would have been getting itchy anyway because he's never had a job more than 5 years.
Right. But you know what? And I'm still to this day, I don't believe Jimmy when he says that he's got no second thoughts, no regrets about leaving when he did. Because, Brad, I mean, and you know this better than anybody, that team was so good. They were so young. Free agency hadn't taken hold yet. They got to the fourth quarter of the championship game in Switzer's first year, and they nearly pulled it out. They never would have fell behind. I think it was 21-0 early in that game. And then Switzer, with Jerry's players, won the Super Bowl the next year. In that third year, San Francisco went on to kill the Chargers in the Super Bowl, so you know the Cowboys would have done it. And then they won it the next year. So that's four in a row right there that Jimmy would have won. And, okay, they lose Alvin Harper or some of the other guys, but Jimmy, as good a coach as he was better at personnel. He would have replenished the talent level. They could have won. I mean, their best players were Aikman, Irvin, and Smith, and they were all young, relatively speaking. They had a young defense with pass rushers. I mean, God knows how many they could have. Maybe something would have screwed up. Somebody would have gotten hurt. But just on paper, you look at them, they could have won 5 or 6 in a row, and that's not an exaggeration because that team was that good. And Jimmy leaving just blew it up, and he insists he has no regrets because his goal in life, his number one goal was to be happy, and he wasn't happy. And I don't believe it. He would have been in the Hall of Fame by now. And Aikman telling him a few years ago, they're having a beer, and you know how much Aikman didn't want Jimmy to leave and how much he didn't like Switzer back from the Oklahoma days. And he says to him, we could have been Brady and Belichick. And Jimmy goes, so? He didn't care. He says he didn't care. And to this day, I think it eats away at Troy. And I know, again, you have a real nice relationship with Troy, and I'm sure at some point you've had that conversation with him that, you know, maybe instead of Tom Brady be considered the greatest quarterback of all time, it could have been Troy. I know Troy's not into the individual honors, but he never had to put up the numbers that Brady did because of the talent that was around him. But, you know, to be the quarterback of a team that wins 4 in a row when no one's ever won 3 in a row, I mean, that would have been pretty cool for him.
Parcells years.
You know, I knew Parcells really well from the Giants. I was there when he first got to the Giants, and then I missed all but the last 2 years with the Giants when I was here. And then he came to the Jets. I love Parcells. As most media people do, because you can walk in with no story and sit down and he can give you 5 stories during a press conference. But so when Parcells takes the job here, and I'm telling you this from the perspective of a New Yorker, I know when he went to New England, Giant fans didn't care. It was the Patriots. They were a crappy team at the time, and nobody cared. When he went to the Jets, people looking at him, he's going to our little brother. Let him go have some fun. When he went to the Cowboys, what are you doing? You're a Jersey guy. You were a Giant fan. You coached them to two Super Bowls. You hated the Cowboys, and now you're going to coach them?
There is no hatred in sports like the hatred that everyone else has for the Dallas Cowboys.
There's no question, and I learned that really quickly here when we would when they would travel, and we, the writers, meaning we, would stay at the same hotel. And in Washington, they used to have barricades around that Marriott in what town was that?
It was Crystal City.
Crystal City, yeah. Right? We're getting old. We can't remember that stuff anymore. And I would go when the
let the record show, I remembered.
So, Brad, I would go to the Giants Hotel here in Dallas when they would play the Cowboys, because I had a lot of friends who were covering the team. I was very friendly with George Young. You know, we'd go out to dinner together. And there was nobody in the lobby. And I think it was a Sheraton off of 114 that they stayed in. And so, I mean, that was a startling difference to me. And so I go to Bill. I know I've told you this story. I say to Bill at his first league meeting in 2003, they have a coach's breakfast. And this was in Arizona, and we're sitting out on this beautiful patio at the Arizona Biltmore. And I say to Bill, Bill, I understood when you went to the Patriots. I understood when you went to the Jets. But, geez, Bill, how are you coaching the Cowboys, the hated Cowboys? That's how people in New York look at it. And he says to me, well, you went from working in New York to working in Dallas. And I said, Bill, I don't think the fans look at it the same way. And you know, we had a laugh about it, but I mean, there were 17 million good reasons why he took this job, and it took 4 years for him to get that 17 million. And it's hard to turn that down. And, you know, he and Jerry were at the same point in their lives. They're about the same age. Jerry wanted to win. Bill still had the need to satisfy his fix for the competition. He always says it's impossible to replace the rush you get at 1 o'clock standing in the tunnel on a Sunday afternoon. And he, as many times as he was saying when he left the Jets, hey, fellas, write this on your chalkboard. I'm never coaching again. I knew he was going to coach again. I knew when he left Dallas it was his last time. And this was a great situation for him. He really did like working for Jerry. And even though he didn't have final say, Jerry gave him a lot of flexibility in shaping the roster. And he really did enjoy it here. The funniest story was, and I've told you the story too, that he doesn't know where he's going to live when he moves here. And his main goal was to make sure he was near someplace that had good pizza. You're from Jersey, you got to have good pizza. So he's thinking about Las Colinas, and Jerry says, no, there's this development in Frisco.
Now keep in mind, friends, this is not when the star is on. Right. We're talking about 2003.
Right, this is a good decade before he even thought about this moving to Frisco. And so he tells him about this development named Starwood. Houses are really nice there. It's not that long a ride. You know, I mean, I would imagine Frisco at that point was still pretty undeveloped.
Sure.
In 1989, when I left, it might as well have been Oklahoma. And so Bill goes and looks at the houses and really likes what he sees and says to the real estate agent, he asks her, who developed this? Who would I be buying from? He goes, well, as a matter of fact, it was, you know, built by Jerry Jones and some of his partners. And he says, if I happen to buy this piece of property, how do we set up the insurance? And the woman goes, well, there's a company that takes care of all that for you called Blue Star Insurance. And Bill says, that wouldn't happen to be owned by Jerry Jones, would it? And she says, yeah, and Bill starts laughing. And he's driving back to Valley Ranch, and he goes into Jerry's office, and he says to him, you know, when there were the coal mining mills or whatever in western Pennsylvania, they had a company store. And the workers used to go in at the end of the day and they can buy all their groceries.
Hence the line from the Tennessee Ernie Ford song, 16 Tons, you owe your soul to the company store.
That's right. Very good.
Thank you.
So it's you know,
now you know what kind of music my parents like. Anyway.
So at the end of the day or the end of the week, they'd have the money that they spent at the store taken out of their paycheck. So Bill goes in and tells that story to Jerry, and Jerry knows exactly what he's talking about. And Jerry says, you know, Parcells, by the time I get through with you, you're going to be wanting only me money at the end every week. But they really did enjoy each other. And I think, I actually think that Jerry regrets more Bill leaving than what happened with Jimmy. The Jimmy thing was really complicated. The thing with Parcells was he just was so down in the dumps emotionally and physically. He felt drained after Tony dropped the snap in Seattle, Romo, in that wild card game, because they would have played Chicago the next week, and he knows he could have beaten Rex Grossman. And I don't remember who they would have played in the championship game the week after.
But the Bears went to the Super Bowl.
That's right. And he felt that that team could have beaten the Bears, and he was so drained and so depressed, thinking, how am I going to find the energy just to get back to that point where Tony Romo could be taking that snap, that he left. I don't think he left like the next day. It was another week or so. But Bill has admitted to me that he should have waited and let the emotion leave the equation and make more of a football decision, because he knew how good that team was. I mean, they went 13-3 with Wade Phillips. They would have won the Super Bowl that year, or at least gotten into the Super Bowl against the Patriots, who were undefeated in 07.
Had they beaten the Giants.
Right. And, right, they were 18-0 going into the Super Bowl. And listen, the Cowboys were a better team than the Giants were that year.
But not that day.
Not that day, and that's all that counts. But I'd like to think, knowing Parcells and knowing the young talent he had on that team, and how he just had, like, what, 10 games of Romo at that point, and he liked Tony so much. I mean, he sat him on the bench for 3 years, but kept him around, wouldn't trade him to Sean Payton. That was the first call Sean Payton made when he got the job in New Orleans. I want to trade for Romo. Bill says no, so he signs Drew Brees. That worked out pretty well. And I think they had a really good chance to at least get to the Super Bowl with Bill that year. And he knows that. He left New England too early, and he regrets that, but he didn't like Kraft. There was nothing about this job here he didn't like. It's just he just felt like he ran out of gas and wasn't going to be able to recharge the tank.
All right, so you mentioned Romo, and that gets us to Romo and Witten, which is it's a chapter of Cowboys history all in itself. And what do you know it's in How About Them Cowboys?
Yeah, they're to this day, as you would expect, because it's only been a few years since they finished playing, they are truly like brothers, and to the point that Jason's now on TV after Tony went into TV a year apart. But the funny story is that they met on the Marriott bus. They fly into Dallas for rookie training camp, and they send the bus to go pick him up. And they're the only two players on the bus. Witten's a third-round pick. Tony's an unknown free agent quarterback from Eastern Illinois. And Witten's a little put off because Romo doesn't know who he is.
Witten, by the way, is 20 at the time.
Yeah, that's right. He was really young.
The youngest player in the league that spring until he turned 21.
Yeah, he was just a baby. And he told me that if he knew he was going to last until the third round, he wouldn't have gone back to Tennessee for his last year. The teams had led him to believe he was going to pick much earlier. And he was really upset. Now, it worked out great because he got to play with Bill, and he and Bill are very close. In fact, Bill told Witten to retire when Romo retired. He thought Witten should just get out while the getting was – what has that expression? Get out
while the getting's good.
And that he was okay physically. And when Witten consulted with Bill about the ESPN job, Bill says, are you kidding? These jobs do not come up every year. You better take this. And so Jason took the job. But so they're on the bus, and they're just chatting, and they don't know who – one doesn't know who the other is. And they get off the bus, and you know, Jason's a little more intense than Tony is.
Just a little.
Yeah. So Tony says to him after they get into the lobby and they're checking in, hey, let's go get some pepperoni pizza across the street. And Jason goes, are you out of your mind? This is the biggest weekend of my life. It's all I've been thinking about. I'm going to go and eat pizza with you. And I would have to suspect that they had pizza together many times since then.
Yeah, I would guess. this is not part of the book, but what you see is the future of this team and franchise.
I think the defense is very good, and it's young. And they have a bunch of pass rushers, and a lot of them, you know, are just developing, like Taco Charlton and Randy Gregory. If they can keep him under control, I think he would have been a first-round pick. He was going to be a really high pick, except for his off-the-field problems. Taco Charlton, I got to see play a bunch because my son was at Michigan the same time. And so I saw him and Jordan Lewis play a lot. And, I mean, this is getting on a tangent a little bit. Jordan Lewis made an incredible interception against Wisconsin in 2000 and what would it have been? The 2016 season, because I was at the game. Now, he should have knocked it down. It was a fourth down pass in the middle of the field with a minute to go in the game. But he made a one-handed Odell Beckham kind of catch, leaping over the receiver and grabbing the ball with one hand. It was amazing. So I think he's going to be a really good player. But I think the defense is real good. They have to get more weapons for Dak. Dak showed against Jacksonville that he has what it takes. They got to take the handcuffs off him, let him play, roll him out, let him use his legs. That's the name of the game today. And just get him a couple more weapons, and I think the offense will be fine. They really missed Travis Frederick. I think it's shown so far that he is their best offensive lineman, and both from a skill standpoint, but also calling out the middle linebacker and setting the blocking formations and things of that nature. So they got some holes to fill on offense. But, Brad, the NFC East is bad. I know the Eagles played well against the Giants in their last game, but it's the Giants who are awful. I think it will come down to the Cowboys and the Eagles, but the Cowboys need to get on a little bit of a roll now. But I think the future looks good because, again, their best players are young players, and they have Dak under control for a few more years and Zeke. And I think Dak's got to earn that second contract. I'm not convinced, and I'm not sure they're convinced, but it's only his third year, so they have another year they can think about it. As far as, the future of the organization, the funniest part of all my interviews was trying to ask Jerry what's going to happen after he dies, and I couldn't get it out of my mouth. It's hard saying, okay, after they put you 16.
When you're dead.
Yeah. So I'm trying to ask him this question, and he knows where I'm going with it, but I just couldn't get it out. I felt, it was kind of insensitive to say after you die, what's going to happen? And he goes, come on, Gary, just ask it. I know exactly what you want to know, but I'm going to make you say it. All right, Jerry, what's going to happen after you die? And he says, a third of the team to Jerry Jr., a third to Charlotte, a third to Steven, and that Steven will have the vote at the league meetings because not only that he's the oldest, but he's been the one that's been with me since day one. But I told my kids, you'll accomplish much, much more together than you will on your own. They understand that. They're always trying to please me here, but it's not a competition to see who can please Daddy the most. They work together. They get along fine. So I think the Cowboys will be in the Jones family, certainly through this generation of his kids. And Jerry told me that he's made provisions for it to be in the family through the generation of his grandchildren. I don't know who's going to step up and run it, but I guess, we'll find out over the years. I'd like to think that Steven has learned enough from being around his father that he'll hire a general manager, even though he's very involved in personnel. I don't know what you would think about that, but I think Steven knows what he doesn't know, and although he's probably more of a football guy than his father is, I think you look around the league and all these teams that win it have a really, really strong football guy, and if Steven takes on a lot of his father's responsibilities running the franchise, he probably won't have time to devote to football like he does now. So I think it'd be in the best interest of the team now to have a general manager. But Jerry is not a dictator when it comes to the draft room. If he's outvoted, he'll defer. So I think that's a good thing for the Cowboys.
The stories in here are stories that only someone with Gary Meyer's credentials and years invested in a craft can tell. The book is How About Them Cowboys? The author is former Cowboys beat writer Gary Myers. And Hanukkah and Christmas are coming, friends. The bookstores are holding your copy right now. Thanks for the time, Gary.
Brad, thank you so much. And I'm so proud of you for having the radio booth named after you. It's well-deserved. They're not naming the press box after me, so it really means something that they named it after you.
Usually you have to be dead, so I really very much appreciate it.
Isn't it nice we can enjoy it while you're still around?
Yeah, it's still a little surreal, but that'll be another movie. Gary Myers, the author of How About Them Cowboys? This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.